faith that what you are doing is worth any price, any risk, worth your future and your fortune and your life. I've got that faith, God help me. I've got to make Greg see the light the way I do, somehow. Get him to listen to me. Get him to believe. JFK was busy as always, the traffic pattern for landing stacked 12 planes deep. Once he had taxied his twin jet to the corporate hangar and climbed down the ladder to the concrete ramp, the howl and roar of hundreds of engines around the busy airport made Paul's ears hurt. As he walked toward the waiting limousine, suit jacket slung over one arm, the ground suddenly shook with a growling thunder that drowned out all the other sounds. Turning, Paul saw a clipper ship rising majestically on its 8 bellowing rocket engines, lifting up into the sky, a tapered, smooth cone of plastic and metal that looked like the most beautiful work of art Paul had ever seen. He knew every line of the clipper ship, every detail of its simple, elegant design, every component that fit inside it. A simple conical shape with rockets at the flat bottom end, the clipper ship rose vertically and would land vertically, settling down softly on those same rocket exhaust plumes. Between takeoff and landing, it could cross intercontinental distances in 45 minutes or less, or make the leap into orbit in a single bound. Everything seemed to stop at the airport, all other sounds and movements suspended as the clipper ship rose, thundering, slowly at first and then faster and faster, dwindling now as the mighty bellow of its rockets washed over Paul like a physical force. Wave after wave of undulating, awesome noise that blanketed every frequency the human ear could detect and much more. Paul grinned and suppressed the urge to fling a salute at the departing ship. The overpowering sound of those rockets hit most people with the force of a religious experience. Paul had converted 4 members of the board of directors to supporting the clipper ship project by the simple tactic of bringing them out to watch a test launch and hear it and feel it. Laughing to himself, Paul ducked into the limousine door that the chauffeur was holding open. He wondered where the clipper ship was heading. There were daily flights out of New York to Tokyo, Sydney, Buenos Aires, and Hong Kong, he knew. Soon they would be adding more cities. Anywhere on Earth in 45 minutes or less. The clipper ships had pulled Masterson Aerospace out of impending bankruptcy, but Paul knew that he had pushed for them, fought for them, was willing to kill for them, not merely because they made Masterson the leader in the new era of commercial transport. He went to the brink of the cliff and beyond for the clipper ships because they could fly into orbit in one hop and do it more cheaply than any other rocket vehicle. The clipper ships would help to make Moonbase economically viable. That was why Paul rammed them past Masterson's board of directors, including the late Gregory Masterson II. The clipper ships would help Moonbase to break into the black if Greg Masterson III didn't kill Moonbase first. But as the cool, quiet limousine made its way out of the airport and onto the throughway, crowded with the world's most aggressive drivers, Paul realized that the clipper ships meant even more to him than Moonbase's possible salvation. He had made the clippers a success, true enough, but they had made a success of him as well. Paul's skin was no darker than a swarthy Sicilian's, but he was a black ex-astronaut when he started at Masterson all those years ago, with the accent on the black. The success of the clipper ships had elevated him to the exalted level of being the black manager of Masterson's Space Operations Division in Savannah and a black member of the board of directors. And the black lover of the dead boss's wife, he added wryly to himself. Paul had never liked New York. As his limo headed through the swarming traffic along the bumpy, potholed throughway toward the bridge into Manhattan, Paul thought that New York wasn't a city. It was an oversized, frenetic anthill, always on the verge of explosion. Even 20 years after the so-called Renaissance laws, the place was still overcrowded, noisy, dangerous. Electricity powered all the cars, trucks, and buses bound for Manhattan. Old-style fossil-fueled vehicles were not allowed through the tunnels or over the bridges that led into the island. That had cleaned the air a good bit, although hazy clouds of pollution still drifted in from New Jersey across the Hudson. Police surveillance cameras hung on every street corner, and miniaturized unmanned police spotter planes were as common in the air as pigeons. Vendors, even kids who washed windshields when cars stopped for traffic lights, had to display their big yellow permits or be rousted by the cops who rode horseback in knots of threes and fives through the crowded streets. Yet the streets still teemed with pitchmen hawking stolen goods, kids exchanging packets of drugs, prostitutes showing their wares. All that the Renaissance laws had accomplished, as far as Paul could see, was to drive violent crime off the streets. There was still plenty of illicit activity, but it was organized and mostly nonviolent. You might get propositioned or offered anything from the latest designer drugs to the latest designer fashions, fresh off a hijacked truck, but you wouldn't get mugged. Probably. Still, the limo had to thread its way across the ancient bridges and along the narrow, jam-packed streets. The windshield got washed, partially, four different times, and the chauffeur had to slip a city-issued token through his barely opened window to the kids who splashed the brownish water onto the car. He must use up the whole tank of windshield cleaner every trip, Paul thought as the limo inched downtown, wipers flapping away. At one intersection, a smiling trio of women tapped on Paul's window, bending low enough to show that they were wearing nothing beneath their loose blouses. Kids, Paul realized. Beneath their heavy makeup, they couldn't have been more than 15 years old. A trio of mounted policemen watched from their horses not 20 yards away. Paul shook his head at the whores. I've gotten this far in life without killing myself, he thought. The girls looked disappointed. So did the cops. Then the traffic light went green and the limo pulled away. By the time he got to the corporate offices and the trade towers, Paul needed a drink. The walnut-paneled room had a bar and a spread of finger foods set up in the back, but neither a bartender nor a waitress had shown up yet. Paul did not see any tequila. He settled for a beer instead. Paul had always been one of the early ones at board meetings, but this time apparently he was the first. The opulent room was empty except for him. Glancing at his wristwatch, Paul saw that the meeting was scheduled to start in less than 15 minutes. Usually more than half the directors would be already here, milling about, exchanging pleasantries or whispering business deals to one another, drinking and noshing. Where is everybody? Paul wondered. He paced the length of the long conference table, saw that each place was neatly set with its built-in computer screen and keyboard. He went to the long windows at the head of the conference room and gazed out at the towers of Manhattan, thinking how much better it was on the moon, where all a man had to worry about was a puncture in a suit or getting caught on the surface during a solar flare. He craned his neck to see JFK, hoping to catch another clipper ship takeoff, or, even more spectacular, see one landing on its tail jets. Paul. Startled, he whirled around to see Joanna standing in the doorway, looking cool and beautiful in a beige miniskirted business suit. He hadn't seen her since the day of her husband's suicide. "How are you?" he asked, hurrying toward her. "How've you been? I wanted—" "Later," she said, raising one hand to stop him from embracing her. "Business first." "Where's everybody? The meeting's scheduled to start in 10 minutes."
"It's been pushed back half an hour," Joanna said.
"Nobody told me." She smiled coolly at him.
"I asked Brad for a half-hour delay. There's something I want to discuss with you before the meeting starts."
"What?" Joanna went to the conference table and perched on its edge, crossing her long legs demurely.
"We're going to elect a new president and CEO," she said.
Paul nodded. "Greg, I know."
"You don't sound happy about it."
"Why should I be?"
"Who else would you recommend?"
she asked with that same serene smile. "Greg doesn't know enough to run this corporation," Paul said, keeping his voice low. But the urgency came through. "Okay, we're not supposed to speak ill of the dead, I know, but his father nearly drove this company into the ground."
"And you saved it."
Paul felt uncomfortable saying it, but he agreed. "I had to practically beat your husband over the head before he saw the light. Every major airline in the world began clamoring for Masterson Clipper ships once Paul pushed the project through its development phase. Yet Gregory Masterson II had almost ruined Masterson Aerospace despite the Clipper ship's success. Maybe because of it, Paul now thought. And his son was eager to follow in his father's mistaken footsteps.